Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest chapter, the latest episode, the latest exciting adventure from Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Miss Leslie Ann Jones, who, of course, is here with me now. Leslie Ann, it wasn't, in fact, a rock concert you were attending last night. It was something else, wasn't it? And I can tell
Oh, yes, it was.
Yes, and tell you're very happy about the outcome.
Oh, my goodness. I went, well, I hacked all the way over to Basildon in Essex, which felt like another country, I have to say.
Yeah, it does, Essex, yes.
A bit of a schlep, and it's right on the edge, isn't it,
of
England. To see my son star as the Beast in Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah.
And it was the first night. It was the opening night last night.
Mm-hmm.
What an extraordinary show. They've had about 2 weeks of full rehearsals to pull this together.
Yeah.
And it's phenomenal. It could be a West End production.
Really?
Honestly. Mm. They all surpass themselves. They're all absolutely brilliant. Seasoned professionals, of course, many of them. You know, the dancers.
Yeah.
I think about half of them came out of Thriller in the West End, the Michael Jackson musical.
Golly. Yeah.
All the children are from local theatre schools, and some of them are really little, sort of 7 years old.
Yeah.
And, you know, extraordinary, absolutely astonishing stuff.
And your son
is on my seat.
Yes, your son is Henry Shine, is that right?
He is.
And he plays the Beast. That sounds like quite a prominent role.
It's the lead part, really. And he's played the Beast before when he was in South London Youth Theatre.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a role he was born to. He's a gigantic boy. He's big and bulky and handsome. And he had a fan club. I went round to the stage door after and people were queuing up to have his autograph on their programmes.
Really?
Yeah. It was like going to a rock gig.
Golly, that's amazing. It looks like you've got an emerging star in the family, Miss Jones. You may not have to worry about your retirement after all.
Well, you know what they say about people who tread the boards.
Yeah.
It's famine and feast, isn't it?
Yeah, of course it is, yeah.
Oh, well, what was wonderful was to see Henry doing what he's trained for years to do.
Yes.
And that was his professional debut last night.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really big deal, whether it's in a panto in Basildon or whether it's on the West End stage, you know, your first professional gig is a thing you never forget.
No, it's fantastic. I'll be going off to see my good friend Tim Vine in panto in a week or so's time. Of course, all the pantos were missed last year. There weren't any pantos because of the pandemic. And do you know, some of these people, I mean, 6 months of their annual earnings comes in 3 or 4 weeks of panto because, you know, it's the full houses, they get paid very well for it. So it's been crippling. So it's delightful to see it all back.
Yes. Oh, yes, it is. You know, we have the same thing with the big church choirs, the professional choirs.
Sure.
Because of all the, you know, especially at ours, Fleet Street, the major newspaper carol services that we have every year.
Last year,
of course, we didn't have any of them. Mm. The choir and the church usually garner most of their income for the following year from the carol services.
Indeed. Indeed. Now, you say it was a bit of a schlep over to Essex, but of course you love going there and it's all worthwhile. Do you know what? I think I'm suffering from a condition which has been identified as HOGO. H-O-G-O, hassle of going out. I think I've got so used now to not going to places. The only place I've been publicly, since the sort of relative end of lockdown is with yourself to Leicester Square for that red carpet film of Jenny Seagrove's that we went to see, okay? That is the only event I've been to in probably the last 12 months, and I've almost become a sort of social hermit. I don't really want to go out and I don't want to go into crowded places. I don't use pubs when it's sort of peak time. I prefer to go early or late when they're quiet. I don't like crowded restaurants. I've not gone to football matches. And I think I have got a dose of HOGO or HOGO, hassle of going out.
I don't think you're the only one, actually. I was saying to a couple of friends of mine last night who came with me down to Essex, I don't see anybody anymore because my circle of friends, most of them have decided that they're too afraid to go out. They don't want to get the virus. That, you know, they've also got used to staying in. I think this is the point.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go out, you've got to get ready, haven't you? You've got to have a shower. You've got to get your makeup on, get your outfit, all of that. And as we age, it takes a lot of energy to do those things. And sometimes you think, I just can't be bothered. I'd rather flop on the sofa and put the telly on.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I was working in St. Catherine's Dock in London yesterday, and my mate, Alan Brazil, lives nearby. He lives in Canary Wharf. And even though I was there for a couple of hours, I could tell that Al really didn't want to organise himself to get out and for us to meet up for a drink, which we would normally have done. And I have to admit, you know, at the end, I was sort of quite relieved and thought, well, I think I'll just go home now because I've been out and I've been working and I want to go home. I've kind of almost converted my kitchen in one of my places into a sort of home bar, because that's what you had to do when lockdown was on and the pubs were closed. And I've come to sort of quite enjoy my home in a way I never have before. And I think that's because we've spent so much time at home, we've started to appreciate it, you know?
Yeah, and it's another thing about growing older as well. I remember my parents, they were very gregarious people. They gave a lot of parties. They went to a lot of parties. They were always out, did something. Mm. But then there came a point beyond which they were at home all the time and they weren't seeing all those illustrious friends anymore. And they just took pleasure in each other's company and grew old together. And I think, you know, that's happening to us now.
Yeah, well, yeah, sort of. It's just an appreciation of life. I mean, like you, during my working life, I could sometimes be at home for 40 minutes a day, literally, you know what I mean? Awake, obviously. But I would sometimes come home 10 at night, I'd be in bed by 10:30, I'd be up at 6 in the morning and out again, and do that for weeks and weeks on end. And then at other times, like yourself, I'd be away at a tournament and I wouldn't be here for a month or something like that, you know? And I think it's just a, as you quite rightly say, a kind of slowing down. Talking about slowing down, one person who is speeding up, and I need to know what you think of this, Miss Jones, is Benny Hill. Benny Hill is coming back to TV. Now, I wonder what you think about that.
Well, it'll never work because the woke brigade will be all over it. Mm. That show was full of double entendres and sex jokes. My friend Cheri Gilliam was in it, actually. She was.
I saw her on the telly yesterday, I think, didn't I? Talking about it, yeah.
Maybe you did. One of Benny's babes.
Yes,
that's right. And do you remember that famous sequence where the speeded up sort of old ladies running up and down up and down the stairs?
Yeah.
I can't see how this is going to work because there'll be too many complaints about it.
Mm. I was always a great Benny Hill fan, okay? I thought he was great because it wasn't just that, you know, all the women in his show were all dressed in lingerie and running around and it was all very, you know, well, sexy, really, I suppose, for better words.
Sexist, I think it was.
Well,
yeah.
It was certainly sexist. But they showed a clip yesterday, I think it was when your friend Cheri Gilliam was on, and it showed Benny Hill at the bottom of a set of stairs and women were going up the stairs and he was looking up their skirts, right? And I thought that was incredibly distasteful because there's a difference between chasing a nurse around, you know, when a nurse has got a nurse's uniform on and you're a sick patient and you jump out of bed and start chasing around the ward. There's a difference between that and staring up a woman's skirt, particularly since now, you know, if you try to access the view up a woman's skirt, it's called upskirting and it's a criminal offence.
It is a criminal offence, and maybe Benny Hill gave rise to it, pardon the pun. Mm. But, you know, since we've had all the scandal about Jimmy Savile and so on, I think people, most right-thinking people, would put Benny Hill in the same box.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I did think he was a very funny man. You know, he invented a character called Fred Scuttle, who was a, you know, a thick guy who was I think he was a porter on a platform, a railway platform station or something like that. But I started to feel uneasy when I was watching this yesterday. And also, I didn't think it was funny. So I thought, well, I'm not going to watch it if I don't think it's funny anymore. Maybe even I have lost my appetite for that sort of thing, you know?
Well, it would be like trying to bring back, what was it called? Till Death Us Do Part, Till Death Do Us Part, whatever that was called, with Alf Garnett.
That's right,
Because he was racist, he was sexist, he was anti-everything, and he ranted and raved. He was based on an American character, wasn't he?
Yes.
That's where, I forget the name.
Johnny Spate.
Yeah, Johnny Spate was the writer of the series. Yeah, but there was a character in an American sitcom on whom that was based.
Yeah.
I can't remember the name, but I mean, it's inappropriate. I think our sensibilities have changed.
Yeah.
We are we are aware of other people's sensitivities in a much greater way than we were back then.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And also, you crave for these programmes and think, wouldn't it be great to see them again? As a kid, I loved Batman, the original Batman with Adam West, you know, dressed up as Batman and Robin. And when I reviewed that a couple of years ago, it just wasn't the same. You know, it didn't have the same impact on me. I didn't think it was particularly entertaining anymore. I think your memory just dims with these things, and I think my memory might have dimmed on Benny Hill. But moving on from Benny Hill, you've also been very busy this week, Miss Jones, celebrating the 30th anniversary of another old great friend of yours, Freddie Mercury.
It's been astonishing, the attention this has got. Freddie's popularity has never waned.
I agree.
If anything, he's perhaps more popular today, 30 years since he died.
Yeah.
And people say, oh, well, you know, the rest of the band have done a brilliant job keeping alive his memory and keeping the music going. Mm-hmm. My argument is that had Freddie not died, Queen would not have had the past 30 years as a career.
Right.
Because Freddie was already over the whole rock star thing.
Yeah.
He didn't like touring. He hated getting on and off planes. He was making music with Montserrat Caballé, the great Spanish soprano, mm-hmm. and he'd invented a new musical genre called rock opera.
Right.
So he would have gone forwards in his early 40s, exploring that to a greater extent, perhaps recording music with other operatic stars.
Yes.
And maybe going out every couple of years to some of the great concert halls around the world, the great opera houses, and giving a concert every couple of years and then retreating into his nice life at his house in Kensington.
Mm.
So I don't buy that Freddie and Queen would still be out there doing the rock tours, because if he were alive today, he'd be 75.
Yeah. Well, Mick Jagger still does it, doesn't he? He's old.
Yes, I know. But a lot of people say, well, look, what are the Stones doing? I mean, they're all, those remaining are pushing 80.
I totally
this
agree.
This has to be the last tour. Same thing with Paul McCartney, although, you know, we think he walks on water.
Mm.
His voice on stage now is augmented by other musicians.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And yeah, he's got two guys on stage who've been with him for years and years. They play guitar and they sing a lot of the vocals.
Mm.
So he's very supported in that.
Yeah.
We've got the Who still going out there. Well, half of them anyway.
Yes.
And you have to question whether this is wise. Should we not have that memory cherished of how they were in their heyday?
Yeah, well.
And does there not come a time to stop?
Well, I totally agree with that. I didn't think the Stones should have gone ahead with their tour, particularly after Charlie Watts died. And anyway, I think they, you know, I think they've become almost a parody of themselves. But talking about Queen, I saw another member of that great band on TV this week, Brian May, and he was talking about all sorts of things. I mean, this guy's had such an incredible life, you know, great musician, obviously, campaigner for wildlife. He's an astrophysicist, but he's also written a new book out on something I've never heard of called stereoscopy. And I tried to find out what stereoscopy was after I'd seen the interview, and I looked it up and I still can't figure it out. It's something to do with the fact that you can only appreciate the world if you've got two eyes, which isn't good news for Gordon Brown. And I'm not being facetious there, but Gordon Brown, as everybody knows, you know, lost the side of his eye in a rugby accident as a teenager. So can you explain to me what it's all about?
I'm going to try. So when you look at a photograph, you're not looking at a flat image. Say you've got a couple in the foreground.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a wedding photo.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got the bride and groom. Behind the bride and groom, you've got maybe the church, the doorway, trees, other people. So you're seeing perspective. Even though it's a flat, two-dimensional piece of paper, you are seeing a three-dimensional image. So what stereoscopy is the production of the illusion of depth in a photograph or a film or any other two-dimensional thing by the presentation of a slightly different image that makes it look as though you're standing in the picture, if you know what I mean.
I still don't get it, to be honest. I mean, I know what a photograph is. You and I have been dealing with photographs all our lives, either having to put captions on them or supporting the bloke that we're working with to take a photograph. And I know what an image of a photograph is and how it can appear to be, you know, like three-dimensional. But I still don't know how you could write a whole book on the subject.
Well, because what he's really saying is that if you have two eyes, you know, your lens in each eye focuses on those things in the near distance, the middle distance, and the far distance. Mm. And it puts all those images together in a way that the eyes can transmit those images into your brain,
yeah.
and the brain can process those things as in perspective.
Mm. Yeah.
Otherwise, everything would look flat and in one line.
Yes. No, I'm kind of getting it now. I once worked for a startup TV station, sports station, which we hoped was going to be brilliant, but unfortunately it didn't work out, like a lot of things in our business. But when we first started, the set was literally a desk with four people sitting next to each other to talk about sport. You see what I mean? And uh-huh. it became obvious after about a week there was something terribly wrong about this. And we had to get an expert in to, excuse me, explain that if you made the set a horseshoe so it had depth, you see what I mean? Somebody was uh-huh. at the back and somebody at the front, it would be much more appealing to the eye. And in fact, it was. So I don't know if that's an example of it.
Well, it's exactly an example of it. It's about perspective. So you've got four people sitting at a desk looking flatly at the cameras.
Yeah.
That's what the viewer sees, is a flat front line.
Yes.
But if you've got a horseshoe or a curved situation, you've got some perspective there. Your eye is more entertained because it can move around the shape and see people at different distances away.
Yeah, no, I get that now. Now, Miss Jones, tell me, who is Mick Rock? I've seen an obituary about him this week. I didn't have time to read it all, but is this guy a top rock photographer?
Mick Rock just died tragically at the age of 72. He was the man who shot the 70s. So you will be familiar with his images from, you know, Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody with the four singing heads.
Yes.
The choral. So he did that.
And
he photographed Queen in many famous situations. He did videos for David Bowie as well as lots of photography.
Right.
He came in at Pink Floyd, actually. Mm-hmm. He knew Syd Barrett from Pink Floyd.
Okay.
Cambridge. They were both at Cambridge University together.
Wow.
And he was planning to be a filmmaker, but Syd Barrett of Pink Floyd asked him to do some headshots for him, and he got the taste for photography. And he went on to photograph Mark Bolan, Sex Pistols, Debbie Harry and Blondie, all kinds. His tag was the man who shot the 70s. He had heart surgery. I knew him actually pretty well because he moved from London. He was one of those guys, had a booming London accent,
right?
You know, and his voice entered the room before he did.
Right, even though he was a Cambridge graduate.
Yes, which shows you that it's not just for toffs.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
There is that myth, isn't there, that only toffs go to Oxford.
Yes.
But he moved to New York in the 70s and he got very involved in the punk scene there and started to shoot pictures. Mm. He lived in Staten Island. I used to see him a lot because, like you, I was in New York very often in those days.
Yeah.
But a very gentle man. He used to go around and have tea with Freddie Mercury and his girlfriend, Mary Austin.
Oh.
And he said, you know, they used to lay it all out with a tablecloth and a proper china teapot and a tea strainer and little biscuits on a plate. And he said it was very sweet, like they were playing house.
Yeah.
I was very fond of Mick Rock, actually.
Yeah, well, I don't know why I've never come across him. You know, David Bailey was a great photographer of the days and all kind of stuff. Did he by any chance design the LP cover for The Dark Side of the Moon?
No, he didn't do that. I don't know who did that one, but that wasn't one of Mick's.
No, okay.
But he did, I think he did Sheer Heart Attack for Queen as well. He's,
right.
But the thing about Mick, you know, you mentioned David Bailey, that's interesting.
Yes.
Quite a lot of these celebrity photographers become celebrities themselves because they project themselves in that way and they seek publicity. Because it's all part of their profile. Terry O'Neill was another one of those.
Yeah, Terry O'Neill,
but Mick Rock, he wasn't interested in his own public profile. He kept a low profile, if anything.
Golly.
And he was in the background. He was in the dark there. He was the guy behind the lens.
Right.
And he didn't want to be famous. He saw that effect on other people and he didn't want that.
Right. Okay. Very interesting. I'm surprised I didn't come across him. We talked about watching a bit of telly a few minutes ago in this podcast. I watched a programme yesterday which made me physically sick because there's a guy called Andy Peters and he's a lovely fella. He does the competitions on Good Morning Britain. And he's before lockdown, he was all over the world, you know, Rio de Janeiro, Singapore, all that kind of stuff. And he's gone back now to going out to these exotic places. And this week he was in a new skyscraper block in Manhattan called Hudson Yards, and it's obviously on the Hudson River side of Manhattan, Lower Manhattan, and they've got a see-through floor 345 metres above the ground, which he walked across. And honestly, I get vertigo watching something like that. I was nearly sick. I just couldn't do it. Could you?
No, absolutely not. Did you ever go up the Twin Towers to the observation deck?
Absolutely, yeah. We used to, you know, when I was trying to be a bit flash and I had a young lady in tow, well, we'd always go and
It's always a young lady, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. We'd have lunch at Windows in on the World, which was the restaurant right at the top, you know?
But did you ever go outside onto the exterior observation deck and
no.
you could stand there and look down on planes coming into land?
No, I never did that.
It was so high up. That was terrifying. Yeah, I think I have a bit of vertigo actually as well. But no, I couldn't walk across a glass floor that high up.
No, I couldn't either.
And they've got these swimming pools now, haven't they, in some buildings?
That's right. They've got one in London.
You can swim at the top of the world.
Yeah, they've got one in London. It's a swimming pool built between two towers and it's completely see-through.
Thanks.
I'd have a heart attack in that sort. I was out in London yesterday. I was working in St. Catherine's Dock, right, and making football videos and podcasts, all that kind of stuff. It's all great fun. Now, afterwards, we went for a drink to a pub on Tower Bridge Road. And I can't remember. I think it's called the Tower Bridge Arms, actually, funny enough. And maybe I'm losing my touch or something, but, you know, you hardly ever order one pint of beer, do you? But as we get the drinks in...
Well, you don't, no.
No, exactly. As we get the drinks in, somebody else came in and I said, oh, what do you want? So I ended up buying him one pint of beer, which came to £6.55. And I was absolutely shocked. I mean, a pint of beer, I know you don't buy pints of beer. Before lockdown, before pandemic, if you paid £5 for a pint of beer, that was quite extortionate. It was usually about £4.60, £4.70, something like that, you know. And I don't know where the £2 rise in beers come from. Have you noticed a rise in prices since we opened up again?
I've noticed a rise in prices in all kinds of things. But I think, I'm not sure where you drink, but... Where my son used to work at a pub in Dulwich, until quite recently, a pint of beer is about £7.
Good God.
I think you've been out of touch for quite a while.
I must have been.
We were talking last night. We were in a pub in Basildon.
Right.
And we bought a bottle of wine, a bottle of decent wine, Pinot Grigio, for £7.
Wow.
And that would have been at least £15, £20, £25 in London.
Yeah. I don't know anywhere where you can buy a bottle of wine for £7, to be honest.
In a pub, yes, and it was decent wine as well. Yeah. But my friend was saying that she goes to a bar in Streatham where she lives, where a glass of red is £10 now.
Yeah, £10, yeah. I've paid up to £12, actually, for a large glass of red wine in a central London pub or restaurant or whatever. I've always, you know, anticipated that wine's very expensive because they have to make a profit on a bottle, you see what I mean? And they have to sort of double, you know, or treble the price that they paid for it and all that kind of stuff. But beer, I must have completely lost touch because I can go into a Wetherspoons in Surrey, Epsom, in fact, I know of one there, and beer's £2.30 a pint. Now, I know you say, oh, it's only Wetherspoons, but I think that's why Wetherspoons is so successful, because that's where people go for cheap beer.
Yeah. Their times are changing. I mean, everything is inflated. We know about fuel price rises and so on.
Absolutely.
I think this is just the start of it, really.
Yeah, well, you could well be right. Okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Portmeister, and, of course, rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Ms. Jones, let me talk to you about another friend of yours from the celebrity world, and that is Don Black, okay? Now, Don Black, for the benefit of our millions of listeners, is a top lyricist, and I was reading a feature about him in one of my journals, and he explained the way that he wrote Thunderball for Tom Jones and how he had to, you know, craft it so carefully so as Tom Jones's voice didn't completely break in two, and that he wrote it from like a blank piece of paper when he heard the theme music written by that great musician whose name I've forgotten, who writes John Barry, that's right, who wrote a lot of the James Bond themes. I mean, that's an extraordinary sort of, you know, craft to get into, isn't it?
Well, it is, but what he's not telling you is the whole story here.
Right.
Okay, so this song was not written for Tom Jones. It was originally recorded by Shirley Bassey.
Oh.
And then Dionne Warwick had a go at it, and neither version was released, not until well into the 1990s.
Can I just point out here that Shirley Bassey, of course, had sung Goldfinger, hadn't she?
Yes, I think so.
Goldfinger! Yeah, that was the film before Thunderball, yes.
Well, Thunderball was the fourth Bond.
That's right.
Goldfinger. I'm not sure what came either side of it. But anyway, when the producers decided to release the Dionne Warwick version, Shirley Bassey sued the producers.
Wow.
And the result was that neither of those versions was used in the film. And Tom Jones was then brought in to record it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was written in a bit of a rush. Tom Jones went into the recording booth and he fainted in the booth after hitting that final high note that goes on for what seems like several minutes.
Yeah.
He actually passed out during the recording.
Good God. Yeah. That's amazing, isn't it?
It's a good story, isn't it?
It's a great
1965,
story.
1965,
yeah.
That was. Mm. If you think about 1965, that was when the Rolling Stones were doing I Can't Get No Satisfaction.
That's right.
And then on the other side of the coin, you've got Tom Jones doing Thunderball.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting juxtaposition, as they say.
Certainly is. Yeah. Absolutely. But Don Black's written loads more than just Thunderball, hasn't he? I mean, I read through this list of credits. It's incredible. Some of the greatest songs you've ever heard. And you say to yourself, and I do sometimes, hang on, you know, I could scribble a few words down in a little poem and then go and find somebody to put the music to them. Does that make me a lyricist?
Yeah, well, it's people sometimes say, what are lyrics? What's that all about?
Yes.
And I always respond, lyrics are poetry set to music.
Mm.
And I've had the conversation with Tim Rice quite often. And
yes.
I say to him sometimes, you know, do you write the words first or does somebody write the music and then they send it over to you and you put words to it? And he said, there is no right way. It works both ways.
Yeah, sure.
Sometimes the melody might occur. He said, it might occur to me.
Mm.
I said, can you play music? He says, I know enough chords on the piano to be able to put those down.
Yeah.
But that's not his strength. His strength is finding the right word which scans to that piece of music, and it's all about rhythm and beats.
Yeah.
And it's so pleasing to hear when it's done perfectly.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, as we're making this podcast now, I think the Beatles film Get Back is being released as we speak, literally. I think it's announced just now that it's been released and it's on Disney Plus, 3 2-hour documentaries. Now, that is the first, we have to have a Beatles story, obviously, in the podcast.
Of course.
That is the first time in my life I've ever thought, do you know what? Because I want to see that programme, I'm actually going to subscribe to this new channel, Disney Plus, because I can't miss the Beatles. But that's never happened before. You know, I didn't subscribe to Netflix because I thought, oh, I want to see The Crown or Game of Thrones or something like that. I subscribed to Netflix after a couple of years because everybody else had and you had to have it. But I am definitely going to subscribe to Disney Plus for the Beatles. What's your view, Miss Jones?
I think so. Yes, I think they've been very clever with this because they are getting us by stealth. If they are making these brilliant productions or licensing these brilliant productions, which the world has to see, and there's no other way of seeing it other than to subscribe and to have a look, then that's what we're going to do.
Yeah.
So bit by bit, they are taking over from the usual terrestrial channels, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And actually, at some stage now, you should get out your bank statement. I still get paper bank statements sent to me because I'm a bit old-fashioned. And just see how many subscriptions you've got, because it's quite remarkable. You know, you pay your BBC licence anyway. My Sky bill is huge. It's well over £100 a month, you know, for whatever services I get on Sky. Then there's Netflix. Now, then there's BT, which is the second sports channel for football matches. So that's four already. And then you start subscribing. I once had a little a YouTube TV station called Two Mikes TV, okay? And we used to put out, you know, amusing programmes, that kind of stuff. And we thought, will anybody subscribe to this? So we charged £2.99 a month. And we got about, in the end, probably about 1,200 subscribers whilst it lasted. And eventually, you know, we just closed it down. But what I'm saying is that, you know, even though that produced a bit of revenue, people would often say, oh, look, you know, I'd love to subscribe, but I've already got six subscriptions. And so you think £3 a month, that's not very much. But when you add it up to, you know, 14 here and 10 there and 11 there, people found out they were paying over £100 a month in subscriptions.
Yeah, well, I mean, the BBC is under threat, isn't it? Because of the row with the palace and this documentary that's come out this week. I wonder whether the national broadcaster will survive because there are so many alternatives now.
Yes, there are. I totally agree. And you know, you're so right. And you get such a lot of choice now on Netflix. You can watch all sorts of things. I don't know if you've ever seen something called Breaking Bad, but it was legendary about, 10 years ago. I only caught up with it about 6 months ago during the pandemic. I didn't realise it was there, but that was on Netflix. And there's hundreds of programmes like that now.
Yeah. I don't watch a lot of TV, as you know.
No, sure, sure.
A lot of it is unpalatable to me. Yes. Sometimes the kids laugh at me because, what should we watch? You know, we went through this in the pandemic.
Yeah.
Come downstairs, everybody, at the same time, have a glass of wine, make dinner. Right, what's on television? Which was a joke because there was never anything that we could all watch together.
Yes, sure.
I tend to watch game shows, like quiz shows, like The Chase, which they laugh at me about, but I love The Chase. Mm. I watch train programs. I love Michael Portillo's train journeys around.
Right. I think they're rather empty, those. Michael Portillo doesn't tell me anything I don't already know or can't already observe, to be honest.
Well, that's because you're so well-travelled, Michael.
Well, probably,
such a man
yeah.
of the world, yeah. Yes. I love anything to do with David Attenborough, the wildlife programs, and National Geographic, great programs of exploring the mining situation in Argentina or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But I don't like most dramas because I feel that they portray women in a very negative light.
Yes.
For the most part.
Yes.
If women are the protagonist of these shows, they tend to be villains or deranged in some way, or they are.
True. Yeah.
They are decoration for the men in the story. Mm. You know, they're just kind of hangers on. Not very much of it is palatable to me.
Mm. Right.
So for that reason, I will subscribe to Disney Plus and I will watch the Get Back trilogy.
Right. Okay. Good for you. A lot of feminism there, Miss Jones. What do you think about the what do you think about the new what's it called? The awards, BAFTA awards rule.
Well, it's the Brit Awards.
Brit Awards. Sorry. Yeah, they're not going to have best female singer, best male singer anymore. They're just going to have best singer. Now you must have been to hundreds of those Brit Award nights. I mean, how is that going to work out?
Not hundreds, because that would make me very ancient
indeed,
but I have been to a few. Look, we know what's coming, don't we? Hollywood will follow. There will be no more Best Actress, Best Actor awards.
See, that's a disgrace. That's an absolute disgrace, that. You know, to sully the names of people like Audrey Hepburn and Meryl Streep by, you know, cancelling Best Female and Best Male and making them as though they were some sort of sexist creature in the past. I think that's a disgrace.
Well, hang on a minute. Nobody's cancelling those people. What you are doing is halving the number of awards, because if you just award to a best actor, which could be a male or a female, that's surely taking away a whole category.
Mm. Yeah,
and it's merging them into one. So the award ceremonies are going to be half the length, which is very welcome to me. Have you ever been to an Oscars ceremony?
No, I haven't, no.
Oh, my God. I mean, you go to these things. You have to be there at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon in your ball gown.
Yes.
You get herded into the auditorium and you then have to sit there. You can't even go out to go to the ladies, to get a drink, anything.
Golly.
And it's stiflingly hot in those places.
Yeah.
And you then sit there for this interminable presentation of all these awards. I kind of welcome the idea. Yeah, I welcome the idea of halving them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also, if you think about it, you are equalizing the talent of actors and actresses. So you're not saying, actually, these women are just kind of there to look nice and to be fodder for the movie.
Yeah.
But you are saying that women are equal to men as actors. And I think that is a way forward.
Yeah. But you see, my objection is this. How can you give an Oscar to a woman who doesn't play James Bond?
What if James Bond in future becomes a woman?
Well, it won't. You know, that's already been established. James Bond, the character invented by Ian Fleming, is a man, and it won't be changed to a woman in any drama produced by
All right, Ms. here's Brockley. Another one. What if the James Bond character becomes transgender?
that won't happen either, because James Bond isn't transgender. You know, when he was invented, he wasn't transgender. He's not going to suddenly become transgender. So what I'm saying is, men play, you know, Saving Private Ryan, okay? Tom Hanks. A woman could not have played that role. Therefore, you're discriminating against women being available for great roles which can win Oscars. Do you see what I mean?
Yes, but there's a difference when you're making a film about a historical situation, which the World War II was. You know, that was male soldiers fighting. That wasn't females on the battlefield. Yeah. So that's historical. The same as you couldn't say, for example, Spencer, the new film about Princess Diana.
Yeah.
You couldn't get a man to play Princess Diana.
Exactly, that's what I mean.
Yes, but historically, she was a female. So where it's a historical story... Mm. And it's not fiction, it's not created.
Yeah.
You can't transpose those people, although technically you could use a transgender actor who could play both.
Yeah, but the point I'm making is that only a woman can play Diana. If the actress playing Diana wins the Oscar, that's discriminatory against men if there's no separate Oscar for best male actor, because he wasn't allowed into the category that won the Oscar. Do you see what I mean?
No, that's wrong. They're all in the same category. But so you'd be pitching, say, for example, Daniel Craig playing Bond up against Kristen Stewart, isn't it, who's playing Diana in Spencer. You'd be putting them on the same, into the same competition and saying, right, which is the better actor here? Mm. It's nothing to do with gender. It's... Is Kristen Stewart a better actor in that film than Daniel Craig in this film?
You clearly approve of this, Miss Jones, yes?
I think it's something we're going to have to embrace. Mm. It's not necessarily that I approve of it or disapprove of it. Mm. I think that it's the modern world.
Yeah,
and, you know, everybody's jumping around trying to be politically correct.
Yeah.
And these things always are extreme when they first change. Mm. But it will settle down.
Yeah, no, it probably will. Just getting back to lyrics for a minute, it just reminded me. I've seen the one of the short takeouts from Get Back, the Beatles film. And I was so amused that George Harrison, when he wrote his greatest ever song, Something in the Way She Moves... It makes me feel like pomegranate. It was first of all pomegranate, and John Lennon gave him the line. I think attracts another lover or Paul
attracts
McCartney.
Attracts me like no other lover.
Yeah. Isn't that great? The way these things
great line.
Together.
Well, the same thing as when Paul McCartney wrote Yesterday. Yeah, the original lyrics were Scrambled Eggs because it was just a question of finding syllables that scanned to the notes.
Yeah,
and then later on, you think about the words. And, you know, you fit words around the song, but you've got to start somewhere is the point.
Yeah.
And the thing about lyrics is it's all about syllables and things that rhyme.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Now, have you seen the programme, which has caused a bit of controversy this week, The Princes and the Press, or The Press and the Princes?
I made a point of not watching it because I don't want to lend credibility to that by putting my eyeballs to it, frankly. I think, you know, we know that this programme was made by Republicans, who disapproves of the royal family. So it's going to be negative before we even start.
Mm.
And I don't think it's right, morally right, to have watched it.
Yeah, I feel a bit like that with you. It's called The Princes and the Press. And I watched a bit of it. I did flick over and watch a bit of it. And I didn't see anything new in that I didn't know as a journalist myself. You know what I mean? You know, all the tales being related by former royal correspondents and people I've worked with in Fleet Street and people I've worked with in broadcasting, radio and TV. Nothing came out of it which was new. And I couldn't see the purpose or the point of it. What I really didn't like and I don't like are people in our profession sort of trying to explain our profession and how we get stories and justify the way we get them and all that kind of stuff. As far as I'm concerned, our profession, journalism and the media, should be as, you know, as mystic, and there should be as much mystery about it as there is about, you know, brain surgery science or something like that. We know how to do it because we're in our business. I don't think we should spend hours trying to explain and justify ourselves to others.
I agree with that. Absolutely. Yes. But I think the bigger point here is the thing that the royals have feared for decades is finally happening. They've become too familiar. Their mystique has gone. I forget who said this quote, but it's a very apt one here. Yeah. We must not let light in upon the magic.
Mm.
And the light has got in
to
the royal family, unfortunately. And we are seeing them for what they really are, which is human beings just like us.
Yeah, no, you may be
right. We don't want them to be like us. We want them to be royal.
Yes.
And we want them to be up there on pedestals, things to admire and look up to. But they are not role models to the rest of us anymore.
Yeah.
And for that reason, they are on their last legs. I think once Her Majesty the Queen goes. Mm. I haven't got much faith in Charles and Camilla, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
And I think that the whole thing will crumble, and I think they know it's coming.
Well, you could well be right. I mean, you know, they might be preparing for that very day. William seems very active these days. He's on the telly nearly every other day now, some charity or another, doing some very good work. That's good for him. I read in, after that programme, after The Princes and the Press, I read a piece by a lady called Camilla Tominey, and she's an associate editor at the Daily Telegraph, but has been a former royal editor. And again, you know, I'm not criticising Camilla in her work, but she seemed to me she was giving too much explanation to people in writing about the motives and the reasons and the why-fors of our business. And again, I didn't want to read that, you know?
I'm afraid to say I worked with Camilla actually loosely at the Sunday Express not that long ago.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, far be it from me to diss another journalist, but I always felt Camilla's agenda was a little bit suspect. She was very much on a trajectory to try and make herself a star. At all costs.
Well, I don't object to people who want to make themselves a star. To be honest, I'd like to be a star, you know what I mean? And if people are ambitious and they want to go for it, I think that makes the world go round.
If you're a journalist, which we have both been, full-time yep. journalists in our time, I think that you are not the story. And the minute you become the story, you're dead.
Mm. Well,
because that removes your opportunities to operate by stealth
yes.
and to go into situations and be anonymous mm. so that you can glean facts and figures for your stories.
Mm.
I think that we mustn't try to be stars. If that happens by default, and in the media, in television and radio, I mean, it's slightly different because
yeah.
you're projecting your personality
sure.
as much as you are stories.
Mm.
And, of course, we know that columnists tend to seek the spotlight because that's all part of their profile. But I think if you're a journalist, if you're a hack,
yeah.
the whole point is that you fade into the background and you observe.
Yeah.
And that is an art that's been lost.
Well,
maybe since the internet came along.
Well, we'll have to talk to our friend Piers Morgan about what he thinks about all that. Obviously, one of the most high-profile journalists in the world. I see, by the way, that he's taken his producer from Good Morning Britain to his new worldwide global show.
Yes.
A chap called Aaron.
Yeah.
I don't know if you knew him, but anyway.
That's like taking your hairdresser or your manicurist or your makeup artist, isn't it?
Well, it's somebody you trust.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. Those people are tremendously important.
Yes, absolutely.
in your public image and your presentation.
Yeah.
And if they are a good working team, it makes sense that they've gone together.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. Now, talking about working colleagues, I was really saddened to read of the death of a Fleet Street colleague of mine called Tom Stoddart. I don't know if you ever came across Tom, did you? We talked about...
No, I didn't. I saw that he died, and I was very sorry to hear that. Well, but I never worked with him. Tell us what he was like.
Well, we were talking about another photographer, Mick Rock, at the start of this podcast, and he was a celebrity photographer based in America and all that. Tom was simply a brilliant news photographer who would go where the action was. You know what I mean? He worked a lot with the... poor lady from the Sunday Times, Marie Colvin, who yeah. was killed. She was killed in Syria, I think, wasn't she?
And in Homs.
In Homs, that's right. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. And he worked with her a lot over the years. He was always where it was dangerous. And some of his portrait pictures, you know, from war zones and, you know, countries that had been invaded, like Czechoslovakia and all this. Well, it wasn't Czechoslovakia, that he was too young then. But, you know, where there have been wars and that kind of stuff are legendary pictures. He never got married, Tom, because he was kind of married to his job. Now, I met him once in a pub in Fleet Street. He'd just come back from some mission he'd been on somewhere. And we got talking, and after about 10 minutes, he asked me which part of the Northeast I was from. And I said, well, I said, I'm not, actually. I said, I'm from Chester. He said, oh, I said, I thought I was a Geordie accent. It's the only reason I've stayed here talking to you. yeah.
Great line.
But he was a lovely guy. And the other amazing story, I mean, he went to Berlin. He went to East Berlin, and he was there a few days before the wall came down. And he was then recalled to London, and he got back to London, and then he got a phone call from somebody in Berlin to say the wall is going to come down tonight. So he told his editors and said, we've got to go back immediately. They said, no, we don't believe you. We've got sources in Berlin, and we've spoke to them. They say nothing's going to happen tonight. So he flew back under his own steam. He just went to Heathrow, got a plane ticket, literally flew in. And in the taxi that took him from the airport towards the Brandenburg Gate, there were two women running up the road towards the taxi, waving their hands and their arms about and crying. And when they stopped and Tom wound down the window and said, what is it? They were the first two East Germans to get through the wall into... Yeah.
What a great picture.
Yeah. The very first two that, you know, that were been identified as East Germans who'd crossed the wall after it had come down. It was amazing. Amazing guy. And the other story I'll tell you about him is, for a long time, he lived with Kate Hoey. You know Kate Hoey, the MP for Vox?
The MP, yes. Yeah, I did a bit of work with her over the years. She's a nice woman, actually.
Very nice woman. And I think she's now Baroness Hoey. And when I was running Talk Radio, before it became Talk Sport, we got her in to do some work. And I offered her a fee. And she said, I can't do it for that. And I said, sorry, what do you mean, Kate? She said, no, I can't. I spoke to Tom. Tom won't let me do it for that amount of money, because they lived together for years, decades. And I was rather puzzled, and I don't want to pry into people's private lives. But when I read his obituary, I found out he got married in 2015, but he didn't get married to Kate Hoey. So I don't want to intrude into people's private lives, but that in itself is a story.
Darling, you've spent your entire career prying into people's private lives.
Yeah, sure. But, you know, you're not going around ringing people up now that Tom's passed away, are you? And say, oh, what happened to Tom at the end of his life? And
Kate, so hang on. Was it that the fee wasn't enough, or it was too much, or it was inappropriate?
No, it wasn't enough. Wasn't nearly enough. And so I thought, crikey, I wouldn't like to be a picture editor in Fleet Street dealing with Tom Stoddart, you know, when he comes back from some mission he's been on and he's got a portfolio of brilliant pictures. He clearly knew his worth, you know what I mean?
So if he never married, or he did marry towards the end...
No, he married in 2015, he was 66.
Okay, so presumably his wife inherited his portfolios.
I assume so. I mean, you know, who knows what? You knock on any door and you get a different story, don't you? I really don't know. Miss Jones, I'm going to be critical of your homeland, Wales, right? Anybody who lives there now has got a second home there. So, you know, for instance, you could live in Bristol and have a second home, you know, in Pembrokeshire or something like that. Is going to be hammered with double council tax. What a mad policy to drive people out of a country.
Well, is it, though? I mean, we've all seen the stories about Cornwall, haven't we?
Yeah.
And fishermen who traditionally lived in these fishing villages, and they go out at 4 o'clock in the morning or whatever it is on their boats and bring in their catch, being no longer able to afford to live in their own fishing villages because all the guys have come down from London, snapped up all the pretty little cottages, and there aren't enough roofs overheads to go round. Yeah. The same thing is happening in Wales. You've got to allow people who are born and bred there to buy a house or to get some sort of roof over their heads. It makes sense. And if you've got people piling down from London or Bristol or across the borders, snapping up all the available property and land, what are you going to do with the indigenous population who were there in the first place?
Yeah, but there's plenty of room in Wales. Cornwall now is pretty crowded, but there's plenty of room in Wales. And, you know, you can build new houses there for local people. You should be building bespoke cottages for second homers. They bring a lot of money in. You know, if I go down to my other place in Suffolk, I'm taking my wallet with me and I'm spending in local pubs and bars and restaurants, and, you know, I'm buying furniture there to put into my apartment, and I'm renting, you know, space to park my boat and all that kind of stuff. They bring wealth.
Well, a lot of, you say there's a lot of room in Wales. A lot of it is national park, which cannot be built on. The Pembrokeshire coast, the area of outstanding national beauty, that can't be built on. Yeah. The Brecon Beacons can't be built on. Snowdonia can't be built on.
Yeah.
So actually, there's not as much land as you think. A lot of that reclaimed coal mining land is not safe to build on because it'll all collapse because there are no foundations. We know about slag heaps.
Yes.
No jokes.
Yes.
I just feel that people are missing the point here. You can't just fling up temporary homes for people who have lived there all their lives. The other thing is that people coming from elsewhere with second homes drive the prices up for local people. They need to be able to afford to eat and to put petrol in their car and that kind of thing, which they can't do if all the prices have gone up.
Yeah, I used to have a second home in Wales. It was a caravan, actually. I used to keep a caravan in a farmer's field just across the border in Wales.
Oh, that's very posh of you.
Well, no, it was a shagging palace, so to speak. You know.
Oh my goodness, family show. Come on.
Yeah, but I mean, you know,
shagging palace.
Well, you know what I mean. I couldn't remember what to call it.
You're coming across like we're not even going to say the name.
No,
oh dear.
No. But I was a young reporter living at home at the time, and couldn't afford, you know, even my own flat or anything like that. So I bought this old wreck of a caravan. It was a romantic move.
Oh, I bet it was, yeah. No shower, no toilet, basic mod cons.
No. Come on, Miss Jones.
She was the mod and you were conning her, yes.
Not at all. Oh, dear me. What have I ventured into here? Right. Okay, folks. That's it for another episode of Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much, Miss Jones. Always a great pleasure to talk and reminisce with you. And to everybody else out there, we'll be back with you again next week.
Did you ever go up the Twin Towers to the observation deck?
Absolutely, yeah. We used to, you know, when I was trying to be a bit flash and I had a young lady in tow, well, we'd always go and
It's always a young lady, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. We'd have lunch at Windows on the World, which was the restaurant right at the top, you know.
But did you ever go outside onto
the
exterior observation deck and you could stand there and look down on planes coming into land?
No, I never did that.
It was so high up. That was terrifying.
I used to have a second home in Wales. It was a caravan, actually. I used to keep a caravan in a farmer's field just across the border in Wales.
Oh, that's very posh of you.
Well, no, it was a shagging palace, so to speak. You know.
Oh my goodness! Family show. Come on.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, but
because shagging palace.
Well, you know what I mean. I couldn't remember what to call it.
You're coming across like we're not even going to say the name.
No.
Oh dear.
No. But I was a young reporter living at home at the time and couldn't afford, you know, even my own flat or anything like that. So I bought this old wreck of a caravan. It was a romantic move.
Oh, I bet it was, yeah.
Very romantic.
No shower, no toilet, basic mod cons.
No. Come on, Miss Jones.
She was the mod and you were conning her, yes.
Not at all. Oh, dear me. What have I ventured into here? Looks like you've got an emerging star in the family, Miss Jones. You may not have to worry about your retirement after all.